We Made This.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, network chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Everyone, and welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. My name is Kurt North, and welcome along to our continuing coverage of Season 6 of The X-Files. And as always, we have a guest with us, and I won't waste any more time because we do have to do some 5 questions of X. So I'd like to introduce Luke Winch, who is the co-host of Make It So with myself, the Star Trek Picard podcast, and showrunner of Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast. So, you know, well known to the We Made This podcast network, well known to myself. Luke, how are you doing, mate?
Hello, Kurt. I'm really well, actually. It's really good to be on the show because I've been orbiting the X-Cast and We Made This for a couple of years now, I think.
Yeah.
So, and I've done some roundtables, so it's nice to be on an episode show. It's kind of full circle, really, because my first ever roundtable, you were the host. So,
well, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so you know, so being here today with you is a nice circle closed.
As I say, we've got to do the 5 questions. So, bearing in mind that I had pretty much the last time I hosted, I think I had 5 questions to do with both Marlene and Katie Doe. So that was a bit of a long episode, and so I don't want to like sort of waste too much time. So let's dive straight into your X-Files fandom then. We'll start with the first question. When did you first discover the X-Files?
19th of September, 1994, BBC Two at 8 PM. It was the actual broadcast of the pilot on the BBC. And I was 16 years old, and I'd said to my mum, can you not watch Morse tonight, and can we watch this new show called The X-Files? I think you might like it. And she did, which is great, but more importantly, I did. And yeah, I mean, that was the first time I watched it. And I was quite an impressionable teenager, really, and I'd already kind of got into UFO conspiracies and stuff like that. And once the X-Files was up and running, you know, I'd use that, you know, that continuous form paper with the holes on the side. I'd like print out like unclassified documents that the US government, and it was all blacked out and stuff like that. So right. I was a proper geek in my teens. So yeah, but I was hooked and obsessed from that point onwards, really.
Oh wow, because I kind of did it the other way around. I caught the X-Files and then started to do that. So so it's interesting how you've done it from that way around, and to see the pilot on BBC as well is yeah, a great one, because as I say, I've mentioned in the past that I caught them later on and out of order and all kinds because of the whole BBC Sky thing. So what about your favourite episode then? What would you class as your favourite episode of the show's entire run?
Oh, dear. Wait, I mean, to be honest, I mean...
Doesn't have to I think be many guests.
Yeah. I think a lot of guests have said that it their favourite episode changes with their mood, or it changes month by month, or changes year by year. I mean, I could say Ice, which is one of the best episodes of season one. I could say Anasazi, which I think kicked off the mythology to the degree it got to. there's Pusher, there's Jose Young from Outer Space. But I think I'm going to go, because we're doing season six, I think I'm going to go with Monday.
Right, okay.
Monday is one of my all-time favourite X-Files episodes. I think it's just exquisitely shot by Kim Manners. It deals with all the themes that kind of hit right in my ballpark, you know, time loops, the science of time and self-determinism and all that stuff. It's the kind of stuff that Fringe deals with a lot. So it fits into my ballpark really well. And I think the humour hits the mark every time in that episode. You know, there are some X-Files episodes where it doesn't, the balance isn't quite right on serious episodes that have humour, but I think this one absolutely hits the mark. And, you know, the whole Mulder's bed is leaking gag was really good. And but also the pathos and tragedy of the character of Pam, played by the incredible Carrie Hamilton, is just fantastic. So, yeah, I think that's probably one of the best episodes of season six for me and also the X-Files as a whole.
Right, okay. So if just on a side note to that then, because I think I'm aware of, like, season six isn't one of your favourite seasons, and that, the next question is, you know, what's your favourite season? But before we get into that, is the things like Monday being that concept, you know, the scientific thing, is that what really drew you to it? And if you had to choose between mythology and Monster of the Week, would you kind of go for the more of the sciencey type ones, like maybe the time loop ones or even the time traveling ones? Would you go for more the sci-fi elements, or how would you view that?
Again, it depends on the season, because I think in season six I much prefer the Monster of the Week episodes to the mythology episodes in this particular season, because I don't think the mythology episodes are particularly strong in this season, apart from Biogenesis, which is one of my favourite mythology trilogies. But I mean, yeah, it depends on the season. If you were to ask me that about season three, I would outright say the mythology episodes. Mm. But I love stuff like Monday, and I love Synchrony, which deals with time travel and all that kind of science concept and thing. Yeah, so it depends on the season, and I kind of swap between Monster of the Week being my favourite or mythology being my favourite.
Okay, then. So what is your favourite season? What would you class as your favourite season?
I think I'd go with season three, because I think it's one of the most well balanced of the seasons in tone and theme. I think the mythology episodes at this point are some of the are the strongest in season three, and they, you know, they carry through very the same kind of themes of World War II and integrating all that actual history into this made up history, as it were, with this, which I really like. I also think that season three has some of the best quality comedy episodes as well. You've got Jose Shung's from Outer Space and stuff like that. But I would give an honorary shout out to season eight, which is actually my second favourite season. I think season eight is a fantastic return to form for the X-Files after six and seven.
Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to season eight. You know, it's a bit off yet, but it's one of my favourite seasons as well, which is great. What about character then? Doesn't have to be Mulder and Scully. Could be Pam. Could be anyone. It could be Cigarette Smoking Man. It could be Dave Grohl. It could be absolutely anyone.
Yeah, I'm mulled over this for blooming ages this morning. Again, it's like episodes and seasons. It changes over time. I could go for the easy answer, which would be Mulder. I think season six Mulder is really good. I think his comic timing is fantastic. David Duchovny really shows off his comic talent in this season. But I'm going to go with Krycek, because, and the reason I've gone with Krycek is that I like the way he's not bound by any kind of coherent cause or held by any agenda, really. He goes his own way. He plots his own path, and he doesn't really have an allegiance, even though he kind of swaps around. But he's a free agent. He's his own man. He's this little chaotic thing that kind of threads through the story every now and then. I really like that. I like the fact that he is his own man, and he's not used by anyone. Well, I mean, he is, but he always gets his revenge or has his turn and turn of the table. So, yeah, Krycek. He's a great enigmatic character.
Excellent. Great choice. What about your favourite moment from the series then? Again, it's one of those ones that's really difficult. I suppose that you've probably dwelled over this for some time.
Yeah, lots of files. Lots and lots of files. Is that scene where they find the mountain vault, I think for me is my favourite moment, because of the impact that that has on the mythology for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
It expanded it to a huge web and fabric of conspiracy, and I love the impact it has, and it kind of ties in Scully's abduction and Mulder's sister and all these little kind of disparate storylines are all packed into this mountain vault, and I love the symbolism of that and how it just opens up storylines and kind of brings it to its conclusion in season six, really, that particular, you know, those particular plot thread.
And of course, not long after Lots of Files, you get the miraculous escape through a back door, which I always find amazing. You know, the fact that, you know, have all this security and then all you need to do is go out the back door via a pretty wooden door as well, which is great. So, yes, that inducts you into the X-Cast. You know, you are now a guest on the main show, which is always fantastic. Woo-hoo. to induct people onto that. So let's talk about the episode that we're going to look at today, which is episode Trevor, episode 17 of season 6. It aired on the 11th of April, 1999. So it was directed by Rob Bowman, written by Jim Guttridge and Ken Hollier. So what do you think to season 6, just before we get into the episode itself?
I kind of alluded to it earlier in the Five Questions of X, but it's a mixed bag for me. I know it's a lot of people's favourite, and a lot of people think it's the most rewatchable of the seasons. And watching it over this past week, I've actually realised that I think I watched this one the least. And there are some reasons that I know why I don't rewatch it a lot, but there's also some surprises where I think, well, why don't I watch this season more than I do? But I'm a big pre-Fight the Future man. I mean, seasons 1 to 5 in Vancouver for me is the essence of X-Files. I love the gloomy atmosphere quality that Vancouver brings. I know they kind of fabricate that quite well in LA, but it's just the overall, especially outside locations, I think I miss that. There are exceptions, though. I think Drive, Triangle and Monday are three of my favourite and three of the best, I think, episodes of X-Files overall. But there are then episodes like Terms of Endearment and Alpha, which I think miss the mark completely. I'm not fans of those episodes at all.
Okay.
I'm also not a fan of the kind of first stretch before Two Fathers, One Son. I think having that long stretch of light episodes, it is a bit too much for me. I would have liked that spaced out and interweaved with some more darker episodes. But that's just placement. I don't think that's anything to do with the actual episodes themselves. Mm. But yeah, mixed bag overall.
Yeah, well, I kind of allude season 6 to almost like an album. You know, like the first part of the album is like all the singles. That's what it feels like to me. It feels like it's like, you know, the first 5 or 6, they're like, oh, that's going to be number one. You know, by the time episode 6, it's kind of like, oh, it'll be in the top 10. So it is interesting how it's like kind of, it's they're trying to work the way around that.
Mm.
But what about Trevor then? So what would you rate it out of 10 for you? And what do you make to this episode?
Well, I think when you asked me to come on this episode, I was like, Trevor, really? But I think, like, you know, when you have a memory of something and your memory of that actual event, it might be a bit more better than actually what happened. Well, this is a reverse. My memory of Trevor, because I hadn't seen it in a while, was like, oh, this is a bit of a episode. But you know what? I was pleasantly surprised. I actually enjoyed this. I enjoyed watching this episode. I think it's a, for the most part, solid Monster of the Week story. The fact that Guttridge and Horrile.
Yeah.
The fact that they're first time writers, and this, I think this is their only script on the show. I think they showed they knew how the X-Files works. They know the character of Mulder and Scully. I think there's some really good banter between them, especially at the beginning. There's a few inconsistencies in characterization regarding Pinker towards the end, but we'll get to that. But overall, I think it's a solid episode. And I think Bowman really shows his craftsmanship here, because I know that season 6 was plagued with some kind of budgetary restraints. So I think Bowman uses a lot of clever camera techniques to get around that. So I think I rate that quite well. So I think I'd give this a 6.57 out of 10, I think.
Yeah, I was going to go for the same, actually, 6.5. You're right with the budget constraints, because I think it mentioned at some point that during one of the scenes in the hotel when Jackie's been taken away. I think it was Jackie or June, whichever way around it was. There's a scene where Pinker comes in through the roof, and there was there's going to be more of a, you know, you see him come through the wall, but they just didn't have the budgetary constraints. I agree with you, Trevor. Actually, I think I'm going to find this with Summer Season 7 for me, that I never necessarily give bad credits to anything, really, apart from, as you may well know, over on the Millennium podcast, where I gave an episode a 2 out of 10, which I'll be infamous for. But I generally skew it the same as what IMDb does. I would never give anything, or it would be very, very rare that I would give anything below a 6. And it'd be a 6 to 9.75 as such, you know, because I would never rate anything a 10. But again, watching, this is an episode that I've kind of watched and forgotten about, like a bit like you. It's just like, oh, well, it's all right. Enjoy it. It's not exactly memorable. I do remember it. I do remember like the premise, and I do remember certain scenes, but it's not one that I've ever revisited too much, or, you know, even if I did a rewatch, I'm not even sure that I would necessarily skip it potentially. So it is interesting, but then watching it over the last couple of days has been really interesting, because it has some interesting moments. I mean, you mentioned like the two writers, it's the first time that they've written anything. They actually met each other over in Millennium. You know, they actually, so that's how they came across each other in I think it was the props store. And it was through like kind of the companionship. They said, you need to give that story to the X-Files, see if they can get it to come up and stuff, to make it work and things. So it's interesting from that point of view, because what I find really fascinating with this episode is that it could be an episode without any, you know, X-File or even like a level of evil in it. It could quite easily just be a drama.
I was when I watched it, particularly when the revelation of the child comes through, it reminded me a bit of the Millennium episode, "The Wild and the Innocent."
Right.
In terms of these two people basically searching for this child. The motivations are clearly different to that Millennium episode, but it reminded me of that a lot. And I think you're right. I think if you take Mulder and Scully out of the equation, it wouldn't have affected Pinker's and June's story that much. I don't think they would have impacted it a huge amount. And I know that can sometimes be a criticism, because I think there were some criticisms that this episode was very Mulder and Scully light. When you get actors like John Dell and Catherine Dent, who are very, very good actors, and you have lots of scenes without Mulder and Scully, if you've got these two strong actors, they can carry the episode. And I think they do in this case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even necessarily alluding to that, really. I mean, yes, they're actually involved in the plot in some ways, because you get the scene where, you know, they're in the house, that Pinker's got the intelligence to actually use the boot of the car to actually get the travel to find out where June is. But the actual story of, like, he escapes from prison, you could have him, he escapes from prison and he goes on this journey without needing to have any, you know, paranormal things happening. Mm. It's because it just feels like it's a family drama, it's a family dark, you know. And Wild and Innocent's a good show, actually, because I'd never thought of that, really. But yeah, it's just a dark drama about this guy who wants to find his kid, and it's really interesting from there. IMDb scores it 7.4 out of 10. So that's not too bad, to be fair. And that's from 2,339 votes. As you say, Rob Bowman directs it and does a really good job. I think he does a fantastic job in the way that he uses some of the darkness elements. And to give, just before we delve into it, into the deepness of the episode, some of the you know, the body work is, and some of the actual practical effects of work really well in this episode as well.
Yeah, definitely the kind of the effect of the burn and the severance, particularly the poor guy Bo, who gets his face removed. Yeah, that's quite good practical effects, really. Yeah, and Bowman uses a lot of low angles, like looking upwards, and a lot of Dutch angles as well, and first person perspective. And I just think it works overall to really rank up the tension in the episode.
I love a Dutch angle. Whenever I get a chance to mention it, you know, when Star Trek when Star Trek Picard did it in episode 6 or whatever it was, 7 maybe.
Yeah.
I was like, it's all for that. Give me more Duchangles. Right, okay, let's have a look into the episode in more depth then. So we shall go and do that now. Okay, so we start in Jasper County in Mississippi. It was going to be, I think, in Oklahoma, in an actual prison itself, but for various different concerns. I think it's been mentioned in previous episodes that now that you're in LA, it's like being in a big city center, isn't it? You know, it takes you 3 hours to get out of the thing. Whereas if you live where I live, you know, you can drive 20 minutes and be 30 miles away. So it makes a big difference, you know, the fact of where you were in Vancouver compared to, you know, the LA landscape. So they went with this prison farm, which in itself was interesting. I did a little search on prison farms because I was like, I've got a fair idea of what they are. I managed to find a TV little documentary on the prisoners who were asked to go and work on farms and how they can get back to agriculture when they leave. And, you know, it's not necessarily something they're forced to do, but it's more like, you know, they are asked, if you want to be part of this program, then you can go and work on farms and stuff. So I thought that was quite interesting, just as a side note, really. But the opener does really give us an idea of who we're dealing with in Pinker Rawls. The scene itself, it's quite long. I was quite surprised, actually, because going back to remembering what this episode was about, you know, those various elements, I was like, okay, all right. So we've got this tornado, you know, that's fine. You know, we've got this this thing happening, and you know, the fact that Rawls has to deal with the you know, the sheer panic and fear that he gets after what he does. But the scene before that, where they're boarding up the farm, and you know, getting to the point with the nail in the back of the hand, just to show you how, you know, visceral this guy can be. It took its time. It was really kind of like deliberately left. And I don't know if that's like for filler or was it more for effect, that you're just getting an idea of who this man is? Because as I say, the nail through the hand was pretty effective.
Yeah, I definitely think you need that opener, particularly with the guy kind of taunting him. You need to get a kind of idea that this guy holds a lot in. He's very cool. He's not calculated, but he's very cool and silent in his anger. So this guy's just taunting him, and then he's just like with the thing. But I think that the what this opener does is establishes the character of Pinkner. I mean, we find out later on that he drove 62 miles just to wrap a picket around someone's head because they'd cut him off. So it's this kind of persistence and motivation for him to basically exact his own justice on people who piss him off, which is exactly what this guy does. And even though it is quite long, I think it's there to establish that point of his character, which kind of comes up later on in various scenes.
I've just thought of something completely random, by the way. So this is in 1999, right? Okay, so this predates what I'm going to say. That you know, this, that the whole episode was watched by somebody in a particular computer game, and then named their character Trevor in what would be called Grand Theft Auto 5.
Okay, that's
because that's
sort of
thing
tangent
Trevor would do in Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah, that's a tangent.
It is a tangent. Yeah, sorry about that. It just came to me, and you're talking about him obviously going to 62 miles to go wherever he was. That's exactly what Trevor would do. And then obviously the illusion, well, man, this episode's called Trevor. But anyway, yeah, that was a bit of a tangent. I apologize. But you get a lot as well. You get the thing with the guard. Now, this is something that we're going to touch upon in the mailbag later on, because there is aspects to this episode which people have talked about. We say that this, for me, and I think we can maybe talk about it in a bit more detail later on, but we've got the kind of the guards and the prison guard, who's very kind of like, you know, I can't remember what you would call him, you know, Wally, basically, and you find out that, you know, he's saying box him, you know, just no reason for it. Just kind of, well, there's a reason for it, but the fact he's put him in that danger. And it alludes to stuff like that, that's happened in maybe like The List and, you know, episodes in season three. And, you know, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail when we get to the mailbag about where this should fit or where the anagrams are. But The List is where I would equate this episode. It kind of fits in that mold. It fits in that kind of realm of the all right episodes. They do really well in what they do, but they're kind of forgettable, or you can get them mixed up, or you can scratch your head and go, what happened in that one again? And that's what it feels like to me. And having the prison guards in that mold kind of refreshed my mind on that. Like The List, for example, you know, when he's going after the people he avenges. So I thought that that's really interesting that you know, it is alluding back to an earlier time of the X-Files.
Yeah, I think another allusion back to previous X-Files is this whole act of God and bringing God into this, because Pinker later mentions that, you know, that God fixed him so he could get out of prison and fixed his passage. And I think there's a lot of previous X-Files episodes where religion is quite a central point to the character's motivations. So I think this whole act of God that Warden Fellows calls the tornadoes that are approaching the prison is a nice callback to that.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, at the end of the teaser, we find out that, you know, he's gone, presumed dead. And you know, and there's various, and the guard is goes into the room, and we see quite a significant body in two halves, which was a nice way to end the opening scene on, really, wasn't it? So what I also find really interesting as well is something that came up of late, is that we tend to get a lot of the you know, the memes or the GIF files that we get on Twitter and the like, and they always seem to be off random episodes. And this one is another case in point that, you know, they're not particularly the best episodes that you're ever going to get, but they've got memorable lines in them. Yeah. And this one's got a couple of, like, Scully saying, shut up. And Mulder, you know, saying, my heart, dear diary, my heart leapt when Scully suggested spontaneous human combustion.
And should we arrest David Copperfield? Yes, but not for this, which is one of my favourites.
Yeah, and the fact about David Copperfield as well is I like that they're in both cases of, like, you know, he can walk through walls and he can, you know, he was such a, if you think back to that time, maybe slightly earlier than this, when, you know, he would go to the Bermuda Triangle and he'd make the Statue of Liberty disappear and all kinds. But, you know, there's aspects of this episode which links in with that as well, which they don't know yet.
Yeah.
So, and like, thematically, it works quite well. But yeah, there is a, obviously it's a typical, again, you know, autopsy scene, but with the Mulder and Scully kind of dynamic, I think actually works quite well in this case.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also, you know, those kind of banter and that kind of the kind of quotes that we were just saying is a real testament to these two writers. They know the characters of Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
And they know them well, because it shows in the writing of of these two characters. So this kind of opening scene, autopsy, throwing theories around of you know, their first theories of what it could be, really feels like classic X-Files. And I think it works really well in this scene.
Yeah, it does. And as I say, the funny exchanges that we've got, and you know, it feels like home, and which is great.
Yeah.
It feels like, not the episode, but it just feels like home. When we do get to the prison guard, though, he starts to have his own theories about it being a ghost, and it had Pinker rolls all over it. And it's nice that you've got someone who just so overtly, you know, thinks something's not wrong, someone's really wrong here, because you don't often get that in the show. I don't feel that you get that in the show, where someone overtly just goes, well, it's going, I think it's a ghost kind of thing. It's that was nice and refreshing as well.
Yeah, it's when the guy was talking, all I could think was, and I apologise for my accent here, American friends, why'd you put the Barney back in the box?
Yes,
all I could think about when he was talking. But it is nice to have this character kind of throw this out there. It's like, well, you know, no man killed the warden, because there was no way into the room. Yeah. So, yeah, it was nice that a character is that kind of open in his thinking.
What do you think to the leaps then? Because season six has a... kind of a criticism put on it that you've got these things that happen which are very Twilight Zone-esque, very Outer Limits-esque. You know, they're not really explained, or there's no like scientific thing to catch on to with stuff. Now, this one has a slight improvement in that, because Scully's got the, you know, the electromagnetism. I know you're into your science, I'm probably bastardizing it, to be absolutely honest with you. But, you know, the fact that you've got various different things that they can, electrons that bind things together, that could have broken down by some way in the tornadoes. So there is science in this one. This feels a little bit more of that ilk rather than just having, you know, the story itself. But Mulder's leaps get there really quickly, which I feel he gets there really quickly.
Yeah, it does. I mean, their first kind of play is with, you know, spontaneous human combustion, and they talk about the climactic conditions and the lightning generating high potential of electricity that could have caused the spontaneous human combustion. And then this whole leap that he has of changing the composition of a material as he passes through is a very huge leap. And without actually further evidence, I mean, what does he have? He has a crumbling wall, and he has the handcuffs that kind of break up in his hand. But the leap that he has from that is a little bit of a stretch for me.
Yeah.
And I think it is something that plagues season six quite a lot, are these huge leaps of logic. And I think X-Files works best when, I mean, yeah, it is a fantastical show with some weird paranormal stuff, but an episode works well when Mulder can leap to certain conclusions within a certain grounded frame, really.
Yeah.
And in this, it's a little bit too much. But I do like it later on when they start talking about the electron repulsion of electrons that basically prevent us from falling through a chair when we go and sit down, for instance.
Yeah.
That there's this kind of area of magnetic repulsion that prevents solid objects from going through other solid objects. So they do, it's a very bastardized version of science, but they do kind of touch upon it. But that's way after he's been already leaping to these conclusions. So yeah, it's a bit too vague and a bit too stretched, I think, for me.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I know Fringe obviously has more of an indication, you know, the fact that you're on a Fringe podcast, and you know, I've been lucky enough to be on a couple of episodes, but the Fringe is more in the realm of being able to explain that, and they would probably go more overt with, like, you know, using Walter, for example, to explain, well, this is what we did in tests where we put people through a wall and whatever. But, you know, X-Files isn't designed like that. So I think it has to have leaps in some ways. But to have, as you say, to go through that wall, and then, you know, the glass is kind of like, you know, a good visual representation of what's happening. And that's really important moving forward to the end of the episode. But there is this kind of like sort of logic, which Mulder and Scully are already chasing and following and behind the curve anyway. But to get them there, it doesn't feel right. There's no mention of any previous X-Files, and there's no mention of anything where Mulder can recall, where I recall something like this happening such and such, or, you know what I mean? There's not really that aspect. And we know things can change people. We know that, you know, like, you know, if you think of DPO, for example, you know, he became lightning. So there is things for that. And some of the science can be a bit wobbly, I think, because of the rubber bullets and the pan. So it's like, I'm not quite sure how that falls in. But I do like the fact they use rubber bullets just to give Mulder a shotgun. I do like that aspect.
Yeah, I do. But then the whole rubber bullet thing becomes completely redundant because it does nothing whatsoever. No. And even in the scene later on where Naked Rawls is chasing Scully, there's no sign of any wounds or anything on his chest. And they build up that as well. They go, you know, I need some special sanctioned equipment. And it's like, oh, what's he getting? What's he getting? It's a rubber bullet that does sweet F.A. So it's a little bit of a redundant moment, and it kind of, yeah. Yeah. I was slightly disappointed in that one.
Yeah, that nice idea, but doesn't really pay off. And, you know, it had obviously kind of reminded me of something like, say, Terminator, for example. You've got that fear of, like, he's just invincible. You can't get him. You know, and then you've got the things that do go through him, obviously break down because the cohesion is not there. I like that aspect. I like things like the bullets going through against the wall, and when Mulder pulls up, it looks like they're just like little chocolate bars that just break away. I do like that aspect. But going back to the beginning of what I was saying there, that the fact that it comes to that solution really quickly is a bit of a stretch. And I think that's why the story itself is more prevalent than the actual X-File. It's more about, and that's something we can maybe talk about now, in a second, it's more about the family dynamic and what's happened with those three or four people that we are following this week. But just before we do that, apparently that when Mulder pushed the wall, originally it came up with a little square box, and I think it was maybe Rob Bowman that said that he felt that, just waiting for Bugs Bunny or something like that just to pop the head in. so it was just like brilliant. So luckily in one take, or they were expecting it to. I think it said they might have been expecting it to, but it came through and their one take actually worked quite well. When we kind of have, as I say, the family dynamic of this, because we can talk about that now. It's like, so Bowman has said, this is something else is touched upon in the mailbag, but we'll touch upon it now. Bowman has said that he sees that June is the real villain of the piece. But as a dynamic of the episode, which I think works really well, is the fact that, you know, you mentioned about going 62 miles to do what Pinker wanted to do. You've got June fearing for her life, and going on the run, effectively trying to hide away from her past and move on with her life. And then you've obviously got June giving the child away. You know, we've got all kind of mannerisms that could have been at play there on reasons why she wanted to do that, including fear of what he may become. You know, it could have gone down that route. But this aspect of, like, you know, the real mundanity of it, the fact that Pinker, you know, he wasn't someone, he was a normal person who has something happened to him. And as you say, the belief that was done to him for a particular reason, and he goes on this mission, makes him such a, it's quite a, I know that a couple of people are like terrifying or scary person, because he's someone who's got a purpose in life. He's going to do everything he can to get the very thing he wants. You know, and with his past history, we know what he's capable of. But it is interesting that there's this little discussion about that family unit in total, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely, and I kind of agree with Bowman's point of view that June is the villain, because I think you can look at June's point of view and Roll's point of view and kind of almost sympathise with both of them. You know, Roll's has discovered that he's got a child that has been hidden from him, and he hasn't been told about it, and he's heard, as he says, from a guy who works in the field, from a guy, which is what brings him to believe that this is God speaking to him and telling him that he's got this child. I kind of wish they'd expanded a little bit on the whole God theme and the whole religion theme, because I think that's a strong motivator for Rawls, you know, from the very beginning. And I think if they'd just maybe spent a scene or two or part of a scene just kind of expanding on that, I think we could have really appreciated Rawls's motivations just in a wider context of things. He is this very unpredictable, scary man. You know, he barges into Jackie into her house and terrifies her. But when you discover that he's looking for his son, you know, give me what I want. And for a while you think it's June, and then you think it's money, and then we find out it's his child. In that scene where he sees his son, there is a complete change in his behaviour, and in the way he talks to Jackie as well. Taking June out of the equation for a minute, because as soon as she speaks up, he switches back to his psycho self, as it were. But he's quite sympathetic in that he has this child that he has never seen and has been keeping from him. So I like that aspect of it. I like the fact that the writers are trying to get us to look at it from his perspective, as well as June, who has in her eyes protected her son. The fact that she used all the money is a debatable point as well, because, you know, was she right to do that? And knowing that he could get out of prison and knowing the repercussions of it, was it the right thing for her to do? That's an interesting question as well.
Yeah, well, I was going to bring that up actually, because there's three elements, isn't there? There's, like, you know, he goes to the old boyfriend's house and you think, oh, he's coming for June. I want what I want. You know, it's like, you know, what, and it's June that he wants. Then you've got the, as you say, the 90,000 from the robbery. You know, which obviously alludes to the fact of his criminal background as well, that we get that history of him. And then we find out it is actually Trevor, who's obviously the title of the episode. But it's because it's like, so it's, you're right to bring that up, because it's, I personally, for me, I don't see it being like, as clean cut as that's the villain of the episode. I don't think it's written like that. I think it's written more like a melodrama that's, you know, everyone has the faults, everyone has their areas, and it's almost like, you know, by the very basis of where they've grew up from or the history that they've had, and the paths that they've led, you know, and the fact that their paths have departed because he's gone into jail and gone into prison. And what she's done is trying to forget that and move on with her life, you know, with, you know, money that she wouldn't have necessarily had ever. And, you know, it's a lot of money. And to be able to, like, so then progress that on, and then move that on. Yes, is it a, should she have just said, I found the money, here you go, hand it back. Then, yeah. But for me, it's an interesting thing of like, what would their backstory have been? How have they been together when they were young? How have they got together? What made him do that? What made him become the prisoner that he is today? What made her make that decision? What kind of destituteness was she in that household with Bo? So there's questions that need to be asked. And I quite like the idea that we don't get those answers. But it is interesting that, you know, no one is holier than thou, and I actually like it for that reason. It's dark, you know. It's not just a case of, like, you know, the way that June is portrayed at the beginning is very much like she's moved on with her life, she's made herself up, she's, you know, living the suburban lifestyle, which is just a facade, really.
It is, and that kind of links in with Arcadia a little bit, because we see her in this idyllic house. You know, she's got this new partner, Robert, who seems to be a very good man, a very honest man. And she's lied to him. She's basically kept these dark secrets from him. And that scene's really interesting when Mulder and Scully are talking to her, and he's stood in the doorway and he's listening to all these revelations about where the money's come from, and she was with this convict who's now escaped from prison, this dangerous man. And you really feel for him at that point. You really feel for Robert. And even when they're coming out and Mulder and Scully are taking June into protective custody, and he's like, no, you know, this has nothing to do with me, he's not after me. And even when he has his excuse me moment, which is slightly mansplaining in a way, it's, you know, but I understand his anger and I understand his frustration, because he's been lied to by this woman he's known for quite some time. So the writers have really done well in allowing the audience to sympathise and understand all these different people's point of views, and not just, as you said, the clear-cut hero and villain of the piece.
Yeah, and he was literally on the verge of, like, asking her to marry him.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that, you know, it's gone from one failed swing to something so bad. I mean, to actually buy the PC as well. I mean, proceeds of crime. That PC would have been taken away.
See, I think his frown borrowed even more at the mention of the PC. He didn't mind the house, but the PC, that's it. Yeah,
I don't know what it's like in the United States, but the proceeds of crime here, that would have gone. That would have been taken away.
Oh, yeah.
That's it, you know. That's, yeah.
Who cares about the house? I'm out of here. PC, bought it with that money, I'm out.
Yeah, I'll move on with life and buy myself a cheap one.
Yeah.
So that was good. One of the little things that we get, we obviously have an issue with his clothing, because he keeps going through walls and he keeps losing his clothing. And the scene in the shop with the security guard, which I actually really enjoyed that. I love the fact that he is so, like, you know, he's been down this road before. He's just like, yeah, I'm getting some clothes. Oh, nothing like a good pair of socks.
You know? Yeah.
And that very conversation, and obviously when Mulder and Scully come in afterwards, I thought that that was a really nice little takeaway moment, that you feel that the story's moving on a bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I think John Dell plays this really well in this scene. And also, he's obviously quite a confident man anyway, but I think this newfound ability that he has gives him this arrogance and this super confidence against this guard. Which is why it's so cool, just, you know, putting these socks on and go, oh, you know, these are me, right? These shoes fit, right? So he's got this kind of cool arrogance and confidence because he knows his ability will prevent him from being shot and he'll be able to get out of there. So I like that, how that's established in that scene. I like the way that obviously this ability has changed the way he can interact with law enforcement and other people and gives him this kind of invincibility almost.
Yeah. And then moving on from that, because during the episode, it's quite interesting that we move from like place to place to place by literally following him, because he takes the car. We find the car later. Then the other elements happen and they find the car. And then, you know, we find out, oh, hang on, he's in the boot of the car. So I think they use that really well to showcase what his next steps are.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bowman and the writers have really given us quite a propulsive story, and it's almost like a chase story. But instead of having a protagonist chasing him, we, the audience, are the protagonist. We're following and chasing Rawls as he goes around these different places. And yeah, and I really like that, and I like the propulsion and pacing. I think the pacing's brilliant in this episode. I really do. I can't give enough credit to Bowman in this episode. He's one of X-Files' prominent directors, and I think he deals with a lot of those budget constraints and locality problems, and just shoots everything so well, and it has this lovely rhythm to it, the whole episode, the whole chase.
Yeah, it does. And just little things like they know about the breaking in the wall. They know that that can happen. That when they get to that boot and they see it looking at it, and Maud realizes this, and then runs into that house that we were just talking about. And then you get the "I want what's mine" thing, and the actual mirror as well, which, as I say, gives us our kryptonite, doesn't it? It gives us our weakness, the one thing that we can really hold on to, that will be the main crux of how we get out of this. But it is interesting how they've done that. They've put like a, you know, almost like a superhero slant on it, that there's going to be like this person who seems to be invincible. He's not, you can, Ball tried shooting him, you know, and it bounces just off him. The rubber bullets don't seem to do any work. You know, there's, even when he's come up with, you know, the phone booth at the end, that's only a matter of time before he can break through that. That only weakens him, you know, until the point of actually the actual end result being June. So this kind of thing that they're starting to lean towards more of this science and this superhero element as we get more and more into the seasons is an interesting case in point, especially being obviously the LA years and you know, there's been 5 years worth of storytelling. So they are leaning towards more of that.
Yeah, and Super Soldiers being a case in point. I mean, from season 8 onwards, they are the big bads for those two last seasons. And I know that a lot of people have a problem with this whole superhero, super soldier type element that they introduce into X-Files. I myself don't have a problem with it, and I quite like that element that they bring into it. You could almost say that this is a little bit of a genesis of that, and bringing that theme into the X-Files. Whether or not it's on purpose is another debate. Mm. But I like the fact that they have brought those elements into this, and and kind of bringing a albeit slightly bastardized version of science and bringing that element into this episode. I think it just the show's evolving and it's changing. In season 6, I think, is a statement of change because they've changed localities. The type and style of episodes have very much changed from your standard Monster of the Week. So this kind of experimentation goes on through season 6, and I think this episode mixes that classic Monster of the Week with a bit of the experimentalism that season 6 is doing.
Right towards the back end, really, because we've already met Jackie, and then you know, things start to develop. They're at the house. We see that there's the medical kind of information that we find out, oh, they've had the kids. And there's moments in this episode which is something I don't think I've seen too much of, where you've got Mulder and Scully on two separate phone calls talking about the same sort of thing, but with different elements, doing the investigation work of trying to find out what exactly this is. And then we find out the pregnancy. Now, did you... It's quite, obviously, as you say, it's quite a forgettable episode. Generally, it's something you'd be able to maybe recall, but did you like the aspect of this breaking down of, like, it could be the money, it could be the girlfriend, it could be, it's the child. Did you like that?
I do. I think it's a really good process of storytelling, and it's, you know, these they don't have all the pieces to the puzzle, so they're using the evidence that they have at that time to chase the kind of chase the story and find Rawls. So at the beginning, they just have the photograph of June and Rawls. So they immediately think that he's looking for June. Then they find out that there was money involved in a robbery. So they immediately think that that's then the reason. So then it's quite a logical step, I think, to then. And I do like the way they both come to the conclusion that the child is actually with Jackie. I think that is actually one of the most logical kind of conclusions that they have in the whole episode. I think it's a really good one, that is. So it makes sense from Mulder and Scully's point of view, and from a logical point of view, why these different theories of what his motivations are. I really like it. I think it's a great... It makes a lot of sense.
And I think one of my favourite moments of the episode, actually, is when we get Rawls in the car with June. The fact that, you know, when he's talking to her, and he's not referring to Trevor just yet. I mean, it's a very kind of like X-Files thing to do. Mulder does it all the time. He talks to Scully forever without actually telling him what it is. And Scully's going to draw it out of him. But this whole element of, like, you don't even know what I'm talking about kind of thing. I know what's happened. I thought that the acting of the actress who plays June was really good. From the moment where she dropped a cup of tea at the, you know, in the original story, when the news broke, up until this point where she's literally in the car, stuck with him, and has suddenly realised the real reason why he's pursued her. And I thought it was a really, really good scene, that.
Yeah, it's a really strong scene. And those two actors are both in a TV show called The Shield, which is a critically acclaimed police drama, and it's in one of my top five TV series of all time. It's absolutely phenomenal piece of television. And those two have quite prominent roles in it, and, you know, they are established actors. And I think it's the move to LA has allowed them to kind of delve into the LA gene pool of actors. And I know a lot of people were upset because the gene pool of Vancouver actors is superb. There's so many brilliant character actors, and not all the LA actors that they get in from this point onwards are brilliant. But I think they really caught two great ones for this, and those two make that scene in the car. And I love Rawls just sat there in silent anger with the music playing, and she's terrified and trying to understand what he wants. It's just it's a really tense scene, and that opening, you know, that cold open scene where he's been tortured and he nails the guy's hand, that is all there to basically bring you to this scene, because he's so unpredictable, you don't know what he's going to do when he's sat in that car.
Well, it's also allusions to God as well, isn't it? You know, the fact that you know, you've got the crucifixion kind of the thematic of, you know, and this comes to a head here with the conversation about God, that, you know, that, and there's those little subconscious things that just put it into your mind to think about, you know, how Rawls is seeing this, you know. And you could at a push say, you know, the fact that he did literally crucify somebody before it happened, and this is almost like a rebirth, you know,
which is why I would have loved just a few little moments of scenes just expanding upon this theme of sacrifice and being given an ability to give him the you know, as he says, he fixed me, you know, he gave me the fix to escape, and he gave me the fix, a passage to fix things. So I just wish that we'd had a little few more, because I think that through line of that religious theme is really strong in this episode, and it's basically what his motivation is. God has told him he has a child and he needs to find that child. Yeah. Even though he might be seen as a villain at that point. It's a really interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The more, as the host, as the main host of The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, I really need to try and distance myself from it. But the fact that those two have worked on Millennium, that you mentioned, the Wild and the Innocent, that you could quite easily retool this for a season one or season three of Millennium. And bear in mind, season three of Millennium's airing at the same time as this as well.
Yeah. In my notes, I have this could have been a Millennium episode.
Yeah.
Like the whole story with the family could have been, easily been a Millennium episode.
What do you think to this is the awkward moment, and I think believable that the meeting of Trevor and Pinker. How do you think that went? And what I will say about it is that one of the lines that made me howl with laughter is like, you could have saved me a trip.
Yeah. That is good. That is funny.
I just thought that was a great line. It was just so funny. It could have saved me a trip. It was just brilliant. This meeting of Trevor and Pinker was an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, John Dell's performance here is great, and how he switches from what we've seen of Pinker to this. His face just changes, and he looks at this boy almost in curiosity and wonder. I don't think it's love, because he doesn't know the boy. So I think that's a problem that he has when he's trying to communicate with Trevor. He doesn't know what to say, and he's stuck for words, and he can't even say, I'm your father. He goes, I'm Pinker, but you can call me Pinky. Mm. So he's trying to kind of interact with a child in what he thinks a child would kind of interact with, with a nickname, but he can't bring himself to say, I'm your dad, I'm your father, which I think is a kind of mixes with the flaws of his character that we've seen already, and his kind of anger and rage that he's got about this child being hidden from him.
Yeah, but I also think as well, it's like, how would he react? The fact that he's trying to pass this information himself, that, how is he going to approach this? This is like, he needs to make a good first impression. He doesn't do a very good job of it, to be fair.
No, he doesn't.
But it's through his mind, it's his first, like, ever thing of this. This is the first time this has ever gone, he's meeting his child kind of thing. And the very nature of him is like, how am I going to work this? How's this all going to work in my head as well? And I think the empathy there for Pinker at that moment is quite good, because as you say, he's not just a one dimensional character. He's actually a really well drawn out character. Same as June, same as Jackie. June, I still have a bit of like question mark over the June and Jackie situation. I'm not quite sure how that all came about and what is in going through June's mind, and I'd like to have seen a bit more of why she thought that and how that came to be. The fact that even Trevor believes Jackie is the mother, for example.
It's interesting. Sorry to interject. It's interesting that the first time that Rawls breaks into Jackie's house, he keeps her alive. He doesn't kill her.
Yeah.
And that has massive consequences to later on when he comes back for Trevor. So it's interesting to think what would happen if he had taken a face out or something. It would have been a very different ending to the story.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Well, I suppose he's in his mind, he'd be thinking that she is family.
So, yeah.
Because if the whole episode is revolving around Trevor, who he hasn't yet met at that point, that he's looking for his child, that's the auntie of. Well, Trevor believes it's the mother, but she's the auntie. That, there will be an element of like, that's Trevor's family. You don't, let's not do anything to them. I just want to know myself where they are. And as I said, they alluded to, she's already seen what he's capable of doing. And then she's thinking, let's throw a hot boiling liquid through him. You are fearful. You don't know what you're going to do, but there is an element of like, well, that was never going to really work.
Yeah. I mean, And also, I think up to the point where June goes, it's okay, baby, to Trevor, he's in this moment with his son, and he's interacting with him, and he's softly spoken, and his behavior is very gentle. The second he hears June speaking, it just triggers him. He, in his mind, he's trying to interact with Trevor the best way he can, and be gentle with him. But yet his rage and anger with June cannot be contained. It cannot be controlled. And I think that points to his behavior when he's smashing in the phone box towards the end, and why he stops when he sees Trevor's reaction to his rage, and it stops him from doing anything further.
Yeah, I mean, we can move to that, because Scully does that. Well, Gillian Anderson does a great drop your keys moment.
Yeah,
which is always great. You know, she's obviously a bit scared, drops the keys, and really good for Scully. You know, the fact that she recognizes that the phone box is a good place to go. No allusions to Superman at all, or Kryptonite.
Nope.
Not that I'm trying to link that at all, but no allusions to that at all. And the, you know, when he holds them back for so long. And as you say, when he starts to like break it down, because it's his own desire. That's all he's thinking about. He's not being objective at all. He's being very subjective. You know, he's just in the moment. He wants to get to his child. And as you say, the moment suddenly dawns on him when he actually catches, you know, eye locks with Trevor, that he's actually doing damage to him, and he realizes, has empathy, and realizes that what is he doing? You know, he's taking this too far, and then he starts to step back. And what do you make to the, before we get to the June collision, what do you make to his reaction at that point, and kind of his, you know, his kind of, he not gives up, but he kind of just like accepts that his fate at that point.
To be honest, I'm in two minds about it, because it makes sense that Rawls stops attacking, because he's seen his son's reaction. He's seen that this boy is absolutely terrified of him, which is not the reaction that this father wants from his boy. And as you said, he's all of a sudden taken an objective view of this. He's seen through red. He's seen through the rage, and seen what he's doing. But on the flip side, the episode has built up the fact that Pinkner is so dedicated that's the wrong word. He's so consumed by his rage that he'll drive 62 miles to wrap a picket around a guy's face. Yeah. So I'm conflicted about when he stops. Is that consistent with Rawls's character or not? I mean, would he carry on regardless of this boy's reaction to him, because he's so consumed with wanting to take this boy away from June. But the more I think about it, the more I think that him stopping does make sense, because I think even just talking through it with you, I sympathize with him more than I did maybe with the watch. But at the time, I was in two minds about the consistency of his character and whether or not he would stop or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And the problem, as I say, with June is that she knows that he has the ability to just flip a switch and, you know, he'll be off. So it's it's a harrowing discussion to have about, do you tell him, do you not tell him, do you just, like, he's going to be in prison for the next 30 years or whatever it was that he's going to be, so does he really need to know that? Many people will be shouting at the podcast saying, of course it does, they need to know, you know, which I get that question.
Yeah, and, but absolutely.
It's asking the question that this is asking itself. It's saying, what circumstances can you get beyond that? Or what is the truth? How much of the truth do you need to let people know? It's the fact that, you know, was it a kindness for him not to know, because otherwise he'd be thinking about that in prison? How did he find out? You know, and then obviously this sends him on his mission as such. And then we get the kind of the Twilight Zone ending with Mulder saying maybe he just wanted a second chance, which X-Files has started to do that. And this is where I think some of the allusions to this has been, that Mulder seems to have these little quips at the end of episodes now, where it's like the thought of the week, you know. And don't get me wrong, they've always had them. Glenn Morgan did a Glenn Morgan did a fantastic one in Deanne de Valette, for example. You know, nice meeting you and stuff like that. And they've always ended with like open-endedness. But this season seems to be the one where they seem to do more of the you know, thinking back, what is the meaning of this episode? You know, and Maud is here doing exactly the same, saying maybe he just wanted a second chance. And June, as I say, is the one that actually does the deed, and this is that closure for June? Is that closure for Trevor? Is that closure for Pinker? None of them get a resolution that's needed for any of them.
No, I mean, I suppose June has protected her boy from what she conceives as a threat. So she's got rid of him, and you know, one of the questions behind June's motivations is how far do you go to protect your child? Mm. Even though she's not abandoned him, that's the wrong word, but she gave him to Jackie for safekeeping. So then you ask the question, well, does she have the right as a mother because she hasn't raised the child? Jackie has.
Yeah.
So there's lots of questions going on really good questions going on in this last part of the show. So has June done the right thing by killing Trevor, protecting this child, or does that make her a murderer? Does that make her a bad person? So, you know, even though it's closed off with Mulder's little quip, there are lots of open-ended questions asked.
Yeah, and it's a deeper episode than, you know, I would probably give it credit for before rewatching it recently. So that pretty much, unless there's anything else that you want to bring up before we go into the mailbag, that pretty much brings the episode to an end.
The only other note I had was just, it was a note on Mark Snow's score in this episode, which I really liked, particularly when they break into the room with Jackie sat on the bed after Peter's gone. There's a lovely little piano melody that they do, which I think was really effective to that scene. So, yeah, Mark Snow doing his thing really well again.
Yeah, Mark Snow, incredible musician. Yeah, so let's dive into the mailbag.
Cool.
Right, so we've got Kyle Sweeney up, and he says, rewatched this last night for the first time in a while. To echo some of the others, I think this is a good episode, albeit not one that's ever going to trouble my list of favourites. It's well made, Mulder and Scully work the case nicely together, and Pinker is scary in a believable way. June has good reasons to be afraid of him, so really, I don't really see her as the villain, but she's clearly flawed, which makes her a somewhat interesting character, although she's not as rounded as I would have liked. A solid 7 out of 10. Tony has been on as well. He says, Trevor is an average episode of The X-Files, as you could possibly find. In my eyes, it's not as irritatingly bland as Alpha, given it's a bit more pulpy in approach, but Pinker is a dull version of the kind of men who becomes literal monsters trope. Early in seasons did much better. It's all just a bit boring and empty, especially sitting with the brightness and boldness of season 6, Fun and Games. One I would skip on casual rewatch, which is something I've mentioned as well. We'll come back to that comment because these next couple deal with some of this aspect as well. So okay. I'll just bring it all into one. So Chandru says, Chandru Ravindran, one of the most underrated episodes in the show's run. I was shocked when doing a season 6 pause how low Trevor came in. It's probably my 6th favourite of the season, with Drive, Triangle, Monday, Milagro and Field Trip being the only episodes I think are definitely better. It's got all the markings, of the great monster of the week. I don't think Pinker is super memorable, but he's a chilling one-off antagonist with a compelling paranormal ability. Along with Pinker, I think Trevor does a good job of developing an interesting cast of side characters. They may not be super likable, but I find them able to relate to them in some way, from June's yearning for a new start to Jackie's fierce protectiveness of Trevor. Even June's fiancé's inability to forgive feels relatable, if a bit unrealistic at how quickly he's willing to write the love of his life off. We've mentioned the PC. We don't need to mention that again.
Yeah, that's it now.
Yeah. Mulder and Scully are in great form, as well as the Dear Diary moment is up there with in the pantheon of unheralded Mulder and Scully interactions. And I find their give and take throughout the episode to be refreshing late in a season that relied too heavily on being them cute with each other. And another season 6 flaw that Trevor shrugs right off is the atmosphere. Absolutely amazing. The score, the direction and the general ambience, all top notch. It feels like a classic season 2 to 4 X-Files. Great episode. So yeah, so there's quite a few bits to unpack there, some of which we've already discussed, but I think this idea that Trevor feels like a bit of a throwback to, I could put this in around The List, for example, or mm-hmm. The Walk. It feels like that kind of meld to me. Now, I always have a bit of a thing about doing that because, you know, the aesthetic's slightly different. You know, it's a different storytelling track. Mulder and Scully are in a different, you know, place in their careers and their lives together. But as a general story, it does feel like it could fit in a kind of a season three mold for me.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, if you gave me this episode and I had no idea what season this came from, and you said, right, if you want to put this in a season, I would definitely put it in a pre-season six season. So 3, 4, 5. It is a throwback. I agree, but you know, as I said earlier on, I think there is some of season six experimentation in here as well, and I think there's some of the lighthearted banter of Mulder and Scully that kind of threads through season six quite prominently. So, yeah, it is a throwback, but I do think there is enough here to kind of fit it in season six quite nicely. And I like the fact that it's a throwback, and I like the fact that we've got a Monster of the Week in a very Monster of the Week light season. So I think it's quite nice to have this in here. I know people would think it's a bit redundant and looking back, but I like it. I like it situated where it is.
Yeah, 17th episode of the season. Things are already starting to change anyway. You know, likes of Tithonus, for example. And Carl said that towards the back end of the episode, a season, he actually likes more than the front half, even though you do have episodes which aren't as strong as others. But it has some of the... It feels like season... I think we mentioned this at the top of the hour, that season six, the beginning, feels like the singles. You know, this feels like, you know, them playing around with their new toys as such.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to like the back end. It's like, well, we've run out a bit of money because we've been on a massive cruise ship. You know, we've traveled the deserts, you know, we've done this and we've done that. And, you know, and we've only really had one episode, which was like in a haunted house. And, you know, there's a lot of money being spent. So we have to cut it back somehow. And I think that season six might falter a little bit towards the back end because of that. But at the same time, it feels like they've finished playing with the toys now and they've gone back to the old little toy that they had, you know, last year. You know, it feels a little bit like that. So,
yeah, you can kind of see all the producers and budget people post One Son looking at the things going, okay, we've run out of money, so let's change the storyline, you know, the storytelling, let's kind of do some throwbacks to classic X-Files, because that might not require as much budget as you said, going on a cruise ship or having this big sprawling story of 2001 Son. So,
but even in 2001 Son, they decided to stage it all in a hangar.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. I do think the back end suffers from budgetary concerns, but I think it also, it corners the writers that the fact that they have to produce these stories that are quite contained and maybe aren't as hugely special effects laden and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Okay, so Sarah Ford. Just another thing before I go back in there. We didn't really touch upon Jackie's fierce protectiveness of Trevor, because that's something that, again, picks up. You know, there's little bits of Jackie's character which is alluded to as well, which helps the story.
Yeah.
Sarah Ford, in my opinion, Trevor is fine. It's a workaday X-File episode that seems to fit in better in an earlier season, like we said. It doesn't seem to fit the overall vibe of the season that it's in, though, which is one of the full of quirky experiments. It is kind of the Back to Basics episode. That being said, the cold open is very memorable. Can't put me in the box, boss. Storm's coming. It's something I remember for years. Though for a long time, I didn't remember which episode it was from. Mistakenly thought it might be from one of the season three prison episodes, like The List, strange enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think the horror of the cold open reminds me of earlier seasons. The rest of the episode I remember as being kind of eh. I kind of like the theme of accountability, but in retrospect, was it kind of hard on Pinker's ex? I can't recall the details, but didn't she understand that he was violent and run away with his stolen money and start a life for herself? I don't really blame her for that much for that, but there's a detail. Is there a detail I'm forgetting? Not really.
No.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I don't think we touched... I mean, we talked about June quite a bit, but yeah, I mean, her we kind of touched upon it, didn't we, when we talked about, you know, the writers do look at everyone's point of view. So I think we can, you know, she's not cut and dry the villain of the piece, because as you said, everyone's got flaws, and I think that's where the episode wins, in my opinion, because I think it's a very well written episode that allows you to step into different people's shoes and look at it from their perspective.
Yeah, and then we talk about the villainy, actually. Now, this is where it comes up. So Michael Little says, Bowman said June was the real villain in this one. And he says, no. Andrew Levitt comes back and says, didn't June trick Pinker into getting caught, and then she hid the knowledge of Trevor from him and hid him away? Definitely villain material to me. That's what I like about this episode. It shows us that there are different levels of villainy, and it makes you question which character is worse, June for her cunning or Pinker for his brutality. And I guess there is that aspect, as you say, the point of view, you know, you can latch on to whichever point of view you want to talk about. And they are different people. And again, it adds to that kind of aspects. You know, they were together for some time. You know, June did move on. You know, he was in prison for the stuff that he's done. He's a very kind of, you know, he has those attitudes, like we've said, about how much he can do stuff. I just think that the villainy is maybe just a bit too much. It definitely feels like more of a moral and, you know, a conversation to have about characters and their flaws. Like I said before, I think it's more that for me. I don't see these being villains. I see them as like being very, very flawed individuals, maybe for the position they've found themselves in before all of this ever happened. Why did he rob the bank? Why has he become the person that he was beforehand? Those are the things that we'd like to talk about. And again, if you go back to what we were saying about Millennium was always about asking the question, why did this happen? You know, and if you think about that, you know, why has this all happened? You know, it'd be interesting to look at it from that point of view. Michael Little says, I think she's isn't a good person per se, but she is clearly a battered woman. That's what I like about it. Pinker has some nuance. And then Andrew Levitt basically says, he's got his comments as well. So he says, Trevor is an underrated gem. John Dahl gives a great performance as Pinker, who through clever scripting, we first view as a villain in the piece, only to see him as a victim of June's mechanisms. As such, we come to see his anger, while brutal in its effects on others, as justified. The concept of being able to walk through walls is interesting, especially the pseudoscience used to make it seem plausible. An episode made stronger by the focus on the characters rather than the paranormal phenomenon. And it's chilling. Startling ending. A solid 7 out of 10 for me.
So I mean, coming back to the writers again, you know, these guys, Jim Guttridge and Ken Horrelai, you've got a props manager and a composer, and they've just come together and written this. And it's a really, really well written episode.
Yeah.
Well constructed, characterization's great. So it's I'm on that basis, it's an impressive episode, because these guys aren't, you know, they aren't your classic writers,
yeah,
as it were. You know, they come from different backgrounds, different jobs.
And it'd be interesting to see what part of it's been rewritten and redrafted and back in as well. Heather Benn says, I just read Bowman's take on the episode and I couldn't agree less. Wow, I saw her as trying to protect her son from this violent, abusive father. Pinker is a violent murderer. June is a liar. I really don't have any sympathy for either of them. His performance is solid, though, and the end is moving. Kathy Glinsky says, I think Trevor is underrated, and I don't quite understand the hate for it. It's a good mystery with a truly terrifying villain. There's some fun Mulder and Scully banter, and the ending leaves you unsure whether it was the right outcome, which I like. It's not a favourite, but I like it enough. Cortland Waters Bartley, I agree with Kathy. While Trevor is certainly not my favourite episode from season 6, Pinker is a villain that I find truly terrifying. I also think there is some overlap between Trevor and some other X-Files stories about parents and children that get overlooked for more compelling episodes with that theme. Still, Pinker's drive to see and be with his child is relatable, as misguided, as terrifying as it is, and the fact that Trevor's mother also gave him up is another reoccurring plot point. That's a good point.
Yeah, yes, I think we touched upon this, didn't we, about their morals and their flaws and their motivations. You know, that's what this episode is really good at, is is asking those questions.
Mm. And it's interesting that she mentioned the fact that, you know, mothers giving up the children is a recurring theme, which will come into play, you know, in later seasons. Paige Schechter, Trevor is the worst kind of X-Files misfire, the kind you don't remember too well, just that you know you didn't like it when you first watched it. So, yeah, that draws it to a close there, Luke. So any final thoughts before we sign off for this episode known as Trevor?
Just that this episode is a lot better than I remember it. I'm glad I came on the podcast and did it, and I think I have a new appreciation for this episode. As everyone has said, it is by no means a standout episode in season 6, but it's there as a solid entry. And I think Modern Scully are certainly more energetic in this than they are in the previous episode, Alpha, which is absolute, and excuse the pun, dog shit. But yeah, it's a really good entry, and I definitely think it's underrated.
Excellent stuff. Well, yeah, I think I've come to reappreciate this episode a bit more. I think it's got its moments, and especially with my current, takings on Millennium and we're running through that I probably have a different viewpoint to this than I would have watching this originally, and even lately, especially in the last 5 or 6 years. But having the viewpoint, and obviously growing up and having different, you know, a different perspective to when you're 18, you know, being 40 years old, 41 years old, and I'm 41, not 40. I just had my birthday. That's how inconsequential birthdays are at the moment. So being 41 years old, you know, there's things that you will look upon this episode which might touch on certain elements of your life and things. So I think it's interesting to reappraise episodes as time goes by. And, you know, I think this one's an interesting one in point as well. So, yeah, so that brings the episode to a close. So where can people find you on that there internet, Luke?
As Kurt mentioned at the beginning, I am co-host of a Star Trek podcast called Make It So, which is about Star Trek Picard. So I co-host that with Kurt. I'm also the showrunner and host of Observing the Pattern, which is a Fringe podcast. The third season is currently in production. We are recording starting next week, actually. So, and that should be airing hopefully mid-April, I'm aiming for. I also co-host another Star Trek podcast called Rarely Going, which looks at the Star Trek animation series Lower Decks. So when the second season of that airs, we shall be back on online to do those episodes as well. You can find me personally on Twitter at Luke_Winch, where I'm just geeking out over pop culture and sci-fi and science and all that stuff. So there you go.
Excellent. Well, you can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. I've mentioned Millennium a couple of times. We're just finishing Millennium now. We're in the final stages of season 3. At time of recording, I have got the last final 2 episodes to record, which should be great. One of them with Darren Mooney, of all people, and the other, both of them are going to be with Chris Knowles as well. So both X-Cast regulars, regular guests there. So yes, you can find me on there on the Time Is Now Pod on Twitter at the Time Is Now Pod. I also do the Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, which can be found at Red Dwarf Pod. Make It So, as you mentioned, which I won't re-mention again. And, but best thing to do is to find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. It's rmuldrake to find out where I am, what I'm up to, and, what other podcasts I've got on the horizon, because there's a few. Obviously, Podcast 616 as well, which I must remember to say, which will have all of the episodes of WandaVision. So I covered most of those episodes on WandaVision. And that will be into Passages New and Falcon and Winter Soldier, What If, and all kinds of Marvel Universe shows. So that's the best place to find me. But Luke, thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed your first proper guest showing on the X-Cast.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you about X-Files at last.
Well, we'll have you back on. We will have you back on at some point. Lovely. In season 7, more than likely. But until next time, remember, everyone, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast.
I hate Hollywood. I hate the way these stories are told. It's everything. They hit the same beats. They hit the same rhythms. It's kind of like, you know, reminds me of like a blues thing, you know, where it's like, well, a lot of people love the blues, but, you know, it just, I realize that it's everything has the same underlying structure, you know, everything is like 12 bar, 1-4-5, pentatonic, you know, everything is following the same core elements, and it just gets exhausting after a while.
It does. I remember going to see Gary Moore. And, you know, as much as I enjoy music, I enjoy going to see bands and things. And after about, I'd say, 30 minutes, I was like, I need to check out.
We Buy Records.
How much would you sell this record for on Discogs? Now, the record in question is Microsoft DOS on a vinyl album, which you can actually boot a PC with.
You've got to be kidding.
I'm not kidding. Does this sound bring back any memories? From what I can gather, it looks like they've done it as a hobby project. But if it was commercially available...
All it needs is an incredibly vaporwave sleeve. And I guarantee that hipsters would pay a fortune for that.
We are Starfleet.
So this was kind of a nice callback to the elements that were used on TOS. And it really stuck out to me. And it just, as I keep saying every week, you know, there's always a little give and take, right? Where the writers bring in this element from TOS or TNG or from Voyager, and it fits into the Discovery realm.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they didn't draw out Giorgio seeking medical attention for her issue. I was a little worried.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.